Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I've just got to say, and I've said this so many times, why Genesis Communication Network, if this program is syndicated by GCN, uses SRN, Salem Radio News, which is a ultra-conservative Christian radio network, is beyond me. It is just ignorant. It's irrational. It's unforgivable. And as I agonized why I put up with 16, 17, 18 minutes, an hour of commercials and news, to be on this network, I just cringe with how inappropriate they are. And you know, sometimes you're right to be judged by the company you keep. And I'm appalled. One of the issues in the last segment was repeat from the first hour's news of how SRN is equating ISIS to Al-Qaeda. Now, Al-Qaeda never had anything to do with the Islamic State of Iraq or the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria now. They have specifically disowned them. Even during the time that Osama bin Laden was alive, he said, I want nothing to do with you. I have nothing to do with you. And now that he is gone and you have the new voice, if you will, of Al-Qaeda, kind of its lone representative, he has issued numerous press releases that said, we have nothing to do with them. We want nothing to do with them. We have nothing to do with them. And prior to America's invasion of Iraq, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. None. It was one of the few countries in the Islamic world that had absolutely no Al-Qaeda presence. So here's SRN talking about ISIS being an Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist organization when they have... If there was any organization that you can't say that about, it would be ISIS. Now, beyond that, the Kurds and the Shiite government and in Iraq are at war with each other. The Kurds have said, we want nothing to do with the government. We're just going to carve out this little niche for ourselves. That's something America, by the way, was opposed to. But the Kurds said, this is the first time ever that we've had an area that we actually get to administrate over, which is the largest racial group in the world without an independent homeland. And they have nothing to do with the Shia government. There's no chance they would ever engage with the Shia government. They're enemies. And the government of Iraq is far more ruthless, is far more religiously galvanized, is far more opposed to what is in the interest of the free world than is ISIS. As bad as ISIS is, the Iranian government of Iraq is worse. And so this idea that the world needs to bring harmony to Iraq by having the Iraqi government, which is essentially mullahs in Iran, suppress those that are opposing them, the minority in Iraq, which are the Sunni Muslims, is ludicrous. I mean, the last time they engaged, they used, the Shia government used American attack helicopters and artillery and tanks to just plow through and devastate a Sunni Muslim community. Now, this is a problem that America made, but it's a problem the world cannot fix. No one can fix this problem. It was a natural consequence of us invading Iraq, and, you know, witness the consequence, but stop trying to come up with moronic statements about who's fighting who and why. Now back to the story of Larry Sabato, the political commentator at the University of Virginia and professor there, is absolutely right. This is one of the most profound national events in American politics. I mean, it is on the Richter scale of politics. This is a 10.0. And what's so amazing here, let me give you a quote from a Tea Partier. The person begins, "If I had my wish, I wish everyone in Congress and the Senate would be gone and that we could start fresh. We could start fresh," said a brat voter, Henry Morricone, 70, of the Henrico County, who expressed frustration that Congress has been unable to confront issues such as the federal deficit. You know, you're an absolute idiot, Henry. The only guy that had any ability to slow down the radical increase in federal spending was Eric Cantor. And you just voted for a guy who has absolutely no experience and who will have absolutely no input. You know, you are a Tea Partier because of the federal deficit. Good for you. So what you just did is you just eliminated the only conservative voice that mattered as it relates to the federal spending and deficit. I mean, we have a nation now where morons are voting. So why would we expect anything different? Now, he was labeled as insufficiently conservative, and yet he was extraordinarily conservative. Mr. Cantor had widely been considered the top candidate to succeed Speaker John Boehner. You know, but John Boehner was hugely more liberal than was Cantor. With just over $200,000, this article says, dollars raised, David Bratt, a professor at Randolph-Macon College at Ashland, Virginia, toppled Mr. Cantor, repeatedly criticizing him for being soft on immigration and contending that he supported what critics call amnesty for immigrants in the country illegally. Single-party issue. Amnesty. Single-party, single issue election. Amnesty. And, you know, when you talk to a Tea Partier, if you talk to a religious right-wing Republican, that's their mantra. It's my country. They don't belong here. Send them back. I'm fighting for jobs. They're stealing my jobs. They cost too much money. They don't pay their fair share. Send them back. You know, it's my country. I don't want those other people here. And the fact is they are here. And their children are here legally. And this idea that you're going to send the parents back while the children stay here is nonsense. It's impossible. And you're talking now about the largest voting bloc in America. And they are voting on the other side. And largely they vote on the Democratic side because the Democrats know that they're going to vote for them, so the Democrats do everything they can to advertise in Mexico, come on up. We'll set you right up with food stamps and welfare and Social Security, you name it. You come to America and you got all sorts of entitlements. The door's open. We have really got a mess on our hands and we can't fix this. And in fact, even the only way that you could have resolved this is to go back in time 100 years and repeal the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And then you would have to go back to the FDR administration and repeal Social Security and then to LBJ's administration and repeal Medicaid and Medicare. And food stamps, so that we don't have an incentive to come here and not to work. And then the next thing you'd have to do is repeal the Internal Revenue Service. If you want everyone to pay their fair share, if that's your issue, then just have a tax on spending. So your tax isn't on revenue, it's on spending. So every time you buy something, you pay 15 to 20% of the purchase price goes to the federal and state government. And so you have a national sales tax. That way everybody that's here pays their fair share. Doesn't matter if they're a citizen or not. But a huge percentage now, the fastest growing minority in America, is Hispanics. And they will receive amnesty again. And by getting rid of Eric Cantor, and I can't wonder, I can't help but wonder, is religious republicanism also anti-Semitic? Eric Cantor's was the most influential Jewish politician in the country.
What, Yada?
Yes.
Yeah, not merely Jewish, but one issue that does stick in my craw a little bit, he's a dual citizen. Now, mm-hmm. I have trouble with anyone holding office in the country being a dual citizen. Now, I will admit that, you know, someone could be a dual citizen if they are ethically inclined. They might behave better in supporting the country than someone who was a, you know, natural-born citizen who was a weasel. that's not really true. But I understand from a political standpoint why people might grouse about dual citizens holding office, because it would tend more potentially towards divided loyalties.
Yeah, in this particular case, I'm assuming that his second citizenship is with Israel.
Right.
Yeah, in this particular case, I suspect that his dual citizenship is a direct result of him doing that to demonstrate his support for the only rational, the only civil country in that part of the world, and for the most important, which I think is really the most important country in the world, Israel. And in that regard, I would view Cantor's being Jewish and Cantor's dual citizenship with Israel as being something that demonstrates a high degree of morality and character.
Well,
but I understand
political standpoint. I don't care if it's Ireland or Botswana or Israel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're going to hold office in a country, it seems, you know, because if you're a citizen, then you have access to political contacts in that country, and they have access to you.
Yeah.
So I understand. I, like I said, I don't care if it's Ireland, Botswana, or Israel.
Yeah. But, you know, the that is on a 1 to 10 scale of the issues surrounding Eric Cantor, him holding a two passports, one American and one Israeli, is probably pretty low on the old spectrum. But I wonder how significant it is, the fact that he is Jewish with the conservative Republicans. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I've read now a number of articles on this particular upset, and most now are seeming to gravitate towards the fact that Cantor raised $5.4 million for the campaign, as opposed to $2 million, which means that he outraised his opponent by 27-1. Every article, though, points to Laura Ingraham. They say that Laura Ingraham was able to galvanize opposition to Cantor. It was called ABC, Anything But Cantor. Most of those who voted don't even know who Brat is. It was Anything But Cantor. So it was Laura Ingraham shooting herself in the brain. Not that that would hurt Laura Ingraham. But that's what appears to have happened. It was, in her words, an absolute repudiation of establishment politics, according to Laura Ingraham. She went on to say, he really just didn't have very much money, but what he did have was lots of heart, she said of Mr. Brat. When you say somebody has lots of heart, it means you haven't got a clue what they stand for. Now, here's a guy that says that he ran and that the big issue that he had is that we should make political rhetoric philosophical. We should elevate the debate above the mundane and to that which is meaningful. And here you had him defeating without any issue other than amnesty, the most intellectual man in Congress. It's just amazing how far we have slid. This is now Laura Ingraham saying, I think there will be a lot of people out there saying that this could be something really big for the Republican Party. No, this is something really small. for the Republican Party. It's could well be the death knell of the Republican Party. And the reason I say that, I mean, that sounds extreme, but the Tea Party is not a political party. It's just not. Bratz did not win the nomination of the Tea Party. Bratz won the nomination of the Republican Party. And since there is no Tea Party, and that the primaries are Democrat and Republican, what happened here is that Bratz won the nomination from Eric Cantor. And so Bratz is going to run as a Republican, not as a Tea Partier. There is no Tea Party. And so you've taken the single most effective Republican in Congress and removed him, and you've got a complete novice that nobody knows anything about running against whoever the Democrat will be, which I understand is also a professor of sociology from the same university. So, what now? Are we going to say that an extremely conservative Eric Cantor is not conservative enough, that this this offshoot of Republican politics, this zealous religious Republicanism, is now going to say that the likes of a conservative is not conservative enough, that we want someone who is saying no amnesty, send the Mexicans, even though their children are here, send them back to Mexico. Put up a huge fence. Don't let out any more Mexicans in. Send them all back. Is that what, do they think that they're going to gain a meaningful percentage of people in Washington that are going to hold that view? I mean, it's just ludicrous. No. It's not going to happen. All you did was, if you're a conservative politically, all you did was weaken your position, and you weakened it immeasurably by this. And you really ought to spit at your radio rather than listen to the likes of Laura Ingraham. Mr. Cantor had won primaries in his district, which stretches from Richmond to the Washington suburbs, with as much as 79% of the vote previously. He had won the general election race for the seventh term in 2012 with 58% of the vote. That's a state that just elected a overwhelmingly, not overwhelmingly, it was actually a fairly close election, a Democratic governor. It's a state that has Democratic senators. It's a state that was once Republican, conservative, and now is considerably more liberal and Democratic. This is a quote from Thomas Davis, a Virginia Republican. There's a lot of angry people out there that are upset with the status quo. Eric became part of that. He was the only conduit they have to express their anger right now. So when Eric Cantor, a conservative member of the leadership, is too moderate, is too liberal, that's a chilling effect on Republicanism. Yesterday was a sad day in Afghanistan, and for lots of reasons, five American service members were killed in southern Afghanistan when a coalition jet was called in to help ward off a Taliban attack and mistakenly bombed the Americans. It's sad that when Americans are killed, I don't want the American military to be engaged in Afghanistan. But nonetheless, I am saddened when they are killed. And it's particularly sad when they're killed by what's called friendly fire. I don't know why a fire is ever considered friendly. And when something, when you kill somebody with a bullet or a bomb, it's certainly not congenial. But nonetheless, it is called friendly fire. But think about this for a moment. The President of the United States just traded five senior Taliban officers, five participants in the Taliban that have a far higher rank than anybody that the U.S. Special Forces, those five men, could have been going after. So why were they sent after the Taliban in Afghanistan when far higher prizes in the Taliban were just released from Guantanamo? How in the world can you justify those men being out there in the first place? You know, the issue that is being raised by the media is, isn't it a shame that we mistook our troops and killed our own troops? But I'm saying, what was the purpose of sending those troops out? How can you justify sending Americans out to hunt Taliban when you give up Taliban that have been captured? You know, and the Taliban that are captured in Afghanistan now go to Afghan prisons. And the Afghans are releasing them faster than the Americans are capturing them. And in Afghanistan, it's not five. It's hundreds, if not thousands, that are released. So how in the world do you justify such a thing? Is it that, you know, we have an army, so we got to go use it? We got people trained to go hunt and kill bad guys, so, you know, let's use them. That's what they want to do. You know, this is it's a question that Americans ought to be asking themselves. Why are you doing this? If they're captured and they're taken to an Afghan prison, the Afghans are releasing them. If they're taken to Gitmo, the Americans are releasing them. What is the justification for hunting Taliban under those circumstances? What are we doing there? What are we trying to gain? And it's an irrational, immoral position that the military is in. And by the way, this is not an issue that you can blame on the political control over the U.S. military. It wasn't Barack Hussein Obama that told the SEALs that they ought to go off and hunt the Taliban. It was the NATO commanders. It was American commanders. It was higher ups in the military that told the SEALs to go off and play army, hunting the Taliban. There's not Taliban out there that are trying to kill Americans, other than the ones in Afghanistan, and we invaded their country. You know, you're not keeping America safe by going off and hunting Taliban. And the very fact that if we capture Taliban, they're released either by America or the Afghanis. And what right does the Americans have to squawk at the Afghanis for releasing Taliban when we did the same? We are in a situation now where there is no rational, there's no moral, there's no logical reason for us to be there. Everything we do now is counterproductive. We need to leave. Now, it brings up another issue. Go ahead, Glenn. By the way, you brought up your issue that where you challenged me on the story of Pat Tillman, and I said, you know, Pat Tillman was killed by friendly fire, and that, you know, that my issues there were, here's this guy that was swayed by the political propaganda that if you join the army, you're fighting for your country and this mm-hmm. glorious heroism. And that's why he went. And when he went over to Afghanistan, he found out, no, there's nothing glorious about this. What we're doing in Afghanistan, what we're doing in Iraq are wrong. And that our presence here is counterproductive. I was opposed to that part of it. Still am. I was so the propaganda I was opposed to that caused him. Right. I was opposed to the idea that he was made into a hero that others should follow because he was he decided he wouldn't play football anymore. He'd pick up a more violent sport, which is to join the military. Right. And I was opposed to that. And I was opposed to the fact that once he was there and he was out hunting bad guys in Afghanistan, that the policy was to leave your vehicle, break into separate parties, and then try to walk out as opposed to getting air support or helicopter lift or somebody else to come in and get them. I said, whoever made up that plan ought to be court-martialed. And then I said, you know, then mistaking him for an enemy, they shot him. You know, but I have subsequently read the medical examiner's report, and I've read what the U.S. has released about the Pat Tillman killing. And I should say, before I tell you what I have found, is that my other issue with the Pat Tillman is that the U.S. military and all the way up to George Bush knew, in fact, that it was that he was not killed by Taliban. and yet they promoted it for weeks on end, and they told his parents that he had been killed in an engagement against the enemy, all to continue this myth of the we're doing this great thing in Afghanistan, and he was a hero, when they knew it was a lie. The military deliberately lied. And in fact, the general in charge of the investigation was very proud of himself for the for him covering it up. Now, there is, so all four of those things I have real issues with that are part of the Pat Tillman story. There's a fifth,
right.
You were right. You were right. He was deliberately killed by the United States. It wasn't a friendly fire accident. He was deliberately killed. And the autopsy reports and the I'm not finding this. You don't, in the case of Pat Tillman, you do not have to go to right-wing wacko or conspiracy sites to find out that he was killed by Americans deliberately. You can read the New York Times. You can read the Washington Post. You can read the Associated Press. Every story is the same. Every story is the same. The autopsy is absolutely that the man was killed at essentially point blank range, with a cluster of M16 rounds to his head. That it was absolutely not the victim of accidental friendly fire. He was killed by Americans. Deliberately.
There even accounts that he was yelling, it's me, like even after he had been hit. I'm not sure, but who knows. But it's disgusting, you know.
And the reason was that they had, you know, America had painted him into this great hero, and he was a recruiting tool, and he was writing home that the war was reprehensible.
Right. Which, again, I feel so bad for him, but I mean, I have to wonder if he had just held back on expressing that sentiment until he got home. Rather than feeling compelled to put it in a letter,
The fact is that that America is so patriotic, is so brainwashed in this regard, that he'd have been crucified publicly and publicly humiliated for that claim when he got back home. He might still be alive, but he would have been vilified for making the claim.
Oh, yeah, but there would have been nobility in that. Yeah, he would have gained a certain following, and there would have been nobility in that, just for speaking
truth. Correct.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I want to say there's one other issue with the friendly fire in Afghanistan. This dawned on me several days ago. You know, I'm opposed to the U.S. military entirely. I'd say we'd be a lot safer as a nation without the U.S. military than with it. It might sound unrelated, but there was the Eurofighter. And there's very few of them, crashed. Yeah, very few of them, and it crashed, this past week. And yesterday there was an announcement that Lockheed Martin's expecting an order for another, like, 35 of the Joint Task Force, fighters. That is, of course, a terrible boondoggle.
They're both committee airplanes. The airplane's designed by committee. Good luck.
Correct. Right. But then what it dawned on me, and this is a conversation I had with Aaron. Just by the way, I wish now that 2 weeks ago when I had my off-the-air conversation with Aaron about Eric Cantor and the Tea Party candidate that was opposing him, I wish I'd had that on air. But with Aaron yesterday, what's the purpose of the fighter? Why don't you tell me what we can accomplish with a fighter? You know, the original purpose of fighters was to accompany bombers so that the enemy fighters didn't take out your bombers as they tried to destroy enemy populated areas or their factories. So the purpose of a fighter was to protect a bomber. Now, I want you to tell me, what is it that the United States or any European country is going to do with a fighter? What are they going to do? What are they good for? I mean, it was a fighter here that took out our own troops, because they can't do close-in troop support because they fly too fast. The one plane that we had that could do that was the A-10, but we retired it.
Well, no, not retired yet. They want to, yeah. That plane has to be maintained to, of course, unique role. Anybody who doesn't see that as an idiot. Air superiority fighters can traverse large different distances in short periods of time. You see in movies them dropping napalm and stuff like that. You know,
in terms of them dropping bombs, whether it's napalm or they're dropping guided missiles, they stink at that mission. And that mission is actually counterproductive. It always manufactures more enemy than it kills because those are indiscriminate killing methods.
A ground spotter will put a laser on the target and the plane drops the bomb and it follows into
if they do that, just as we have with our drones, we typically take out as many, if not more, in collateral damage than we even do bad guys, and we don't even know who the bad guys are these days. But the idea that you're going to prevail by saturation bombing or by laser guided bombing, there is absolutely no justification for these fighters anymore. It's right. They are therefore a war that is never going to be fought and that has no purpose. You can't come up with a rational means for America to deploy fighters. What, are the Russians going to invade us? Are the Chinese going to invade us? Or do the Muslims have bombers? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about what on earth is the purpose of having a fighter today. Originally they were to accompany bombers. But, you know, the only two countries that you could remotely think would have an interest in bombing America, and they don't, because we happened with one to be their primary customer, and they'd be destroying their own economy, and with the other, they really don't have any troops or any military outside of their own country and any interest to expand besides their country, would be Russia. Neither of those countries would attack us with bombers if they're going to, and they're not going to attack us, but they have intercontinental ballistic missiles, and the fighters are useless against that. The next would be looking at the Muslims, who are the only ones that have attacked and killed Americans within the last 30 or 40 some odd years. And last time I checked, you could have air superiority against the Muslim jihadists with a Cessna 120. So, you know, you certainly do not need a fighter. Is completely, total and complete waste of money against the Islamic threat.
We have the ability to make them. We have the ability to make them, and we can sell them to other people who might need them. The last time modern equipment, modern planes like that were pitted against each other in dogfights, and also to go against naval forces, was the Falklands War. You remember the Black Days or the British Navy, Mirage 2000 going up against the British Navy and stuff like that. But since then, I mean, in all this proxy war stuff, you don't really see, you know, top gun dogfights going on.
They're absolutely useless. And our problem with, because we can make them, we sell them to other countries, we've sold hundreds of billions of dollars of these to the very Islamic countries that are manufacturing the jihadists that want to kill us. That doesn't seem like, rather than defending America, that's making America vastly more vulnerable. So our military paid for the development of deadly machines that we have sent by the hundreds of millions to those who want us dead. That's why I say we'd be safer without a military. We would not be in this position. We didn't have one, and in this case, these fighters are more lethal to America than they are defensive of America because of who we sold them to and the fact that in America they don't have a mission.
It's very incongruous that this incident occurred because, you know, like you might remember in Apocalypse Now or, when I was in ROTC, it was not uncommon for, you know, pathfinders or, you know, guys on point people to call in airstrikes to give the coordinates and for, you know, the airstrikes to be dropping accurately with Vietnam era technology. So nowadays with GPS accuracy, what possible excuse can there be for this mistake being made?
Yeah, if you look at Vietnam, we were ruthless on our own troops. I mean, a huge percentage of the airstrikes in Vietnam, even brought in by much slower jets and by helicopters, we very often napalmed our own troops and bombed our own troops in Vietnam. And, you know, now here where we have precision GPS guidance, you know, American troops are wearing broadcast capability that says, yeah, we're Americans. In fact, that was how the A7s, the Warthogs, were so effective. I hate to even call it effective, but they were so effective in Gulf War I because all of the American equipment could be distinguished because they were all broadcasting, I'm a friendly. And so if you saw...
Right.
And so it was obvious who the foes were, and our special troops broadcast friendly. So, you know, it's just, it's, here we have total air superiority. There's no one else that even has an aircraft in the sky, and still we can't execute the job appropriately. It drives home the point that we ought not have this equipment. We ought not have special forces in Afghanistan. We ought not have aircraft that are supporting them because the mission is deeply flawed and there's no purpose.
Right. It's just craziness.
It's a trillion dollars worth of craziness. That's how much America spends annually between defense and spying. $1 trillion worth of craziness every year.
Right. Tactical air support is tricky because if you have airfields in the air, then if you can have A-10s in there, that's good. But, I mean, halfway around the world where you only have a naval presence, the A-10, Harrier,
right,
you know, the vertical pickup Harrier, would have fulfilled a similar role. But that's, you don't hear too much about those these days.
Yeah.
And,
the fact is the A-10 was a wonderful tank killer, and it was then deployed in close-in support. But the largest massacre that we experienced in Iraq was a friendly fire from an A-10. It wasn't, even though it was the best suited for that, it still was horrible at that. We killed scores of Americans with our own A-10 Gatling guns. And then you look at the Apache attack helicopters, and the single worst scene in all of Afghanistan and Iraq was when the Apache crew started killing civilians and giggling about it. And of course that was promoted, worldwide, and became the ultimate recruiting tool for jihadists.